10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. There is no writer, and I mean no writer, whose work I enjoy more than that of Wisconsin's own Michael Perry. And I am thrilled to say that Michael Perry is coming to the stage of the Racine Theater Guild this Saturday evening, February 1st. Michael Perry has been a morning show guest on four previous occasions, and tomorrow's program is going to feature excerpts from three of those previous interviews. But today, you're going to be hearing an interview I just recorded yesterday morning in which we touch on a number of aspects of Michael Perry's remarkable life and career. I asked Michael Perry to begin by offering up something of a capsule autobiography that, for the sake of any listeners not acquainted with his story, could have some sense of where he comes from and where he is today.
Yeah, this whole thing has been a slow-motion tangential accident, really. I was raised on a small dairy farm in northern Wisconsin. I grew up milking cows and baling hay and logging. We logged in the winter, so I grew up skidding logs and slinging slabs. And then at the age of 15, I started working on a ranch in Wyoming, a regular working beef and hay ranch. I rode Roundup and did branding, worked on the hay crew. That's how I put myself through college. I got a nursing degree in college. I started working as a nurse, and I liked it. But I also had always loved books and reading, and the idea that a kid from rural Wisconsin could be a capital A author just never occurred to me. But I started writing some things and doing some open mic poetry readings, and then I sold an essay to a magazine, and I loved the process so much that in, I think, 1992, I quit my last real job and said, well, I'll try and be a writer, but I'll probably have to go back to nursing, so I'll keep my nursing license up to date. And all these years later, here we are. I still have my nursing license, but I don't think you'd want me practicing on you at this point. It's been a while.
Not with a syringe, yeah. Anyway, or anything too sensitive. And of course, your experiences as a nurse ended up prompting what I believe is the writing of your first book, which is still probably the book that many people think of first when they hear the name Michael Perry. Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time. And
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I interrupted you, but we wouldn't be talking if it wasn't for that book. And what I always say is it's the old Can You Go Home Again book. It's been written many, many times by many different people in many different ways. But in my case, you're right. It did arise from nursing, but again, tangentially. When I was in nursing school, I quickly learned that the minute anyone would get hurt, someone would say, well, you're in nursing school, or then later they'd say, well, you're a nurse. Well, if you haven't had ER training or you haven't had emergency training, you're not necessarily prepared to handle a car accident or a heart attack just because you're in nursing school. And so I remember thinking, I need to take one of those EMT courses so I actually know what to do. And so I did, and then that led to volunteering and working on the ambulances on the weekends, and then eventually volunteering in my small town and joining the fire department and getting my firefighting certification. And I just did the math the other day. I think I'm in my 36th or 7th year of, now I'm not sure if I did the math right because I'm not good at math, but well over three decades of being some sort of first responder. And so, yes, that book arose out of being a nurse who was always getting asked what to do in an emergency. So, again, a lot of this, none of this was a plan. I just kept going forward and seeing what happened next, and I'm kind of still in that mode.
Sure. And as a matter of fact, I said our first interview was for Truck, A Love Story, which came later. So we never had the chance to talk about Population 485, which is a book I absolutely love. And I would love to just ask you one question kind of adjacent to kind of the heart and soul of that book, which is when one is a first responder, you are in a sense, you have a ringside seat or a courtside seat to many people facing some of the most significant, sometimes harrowing, sometimes tragic moments in their life. And in a sense, even though you didn't plan it, I mean, you couldn't have asked for a more sort of fertile ground in terms of observing human beings contending with some of life's biggest challenges. And of course, there are plenty of funny, comical stories as well. But I mean, that work gave you a tremendous access to a whole lot of the human experience, I should think.
Yeah, and what's really become a recurring theme in my writing is it really, from day one, helped me get a grip on my own mortality. And I think about mortality all the time because of my experiences as an EMT and first responder. And it's not a dark thing. It's just a matter of fact thing. That one of the things you learn in all those years and all those hundreds of calls is that it's coming for all of us, and we absolutely have no idea when and or under what circumstance. And we also have no idea how we will comport ourselves. You know, I've taken care of guys who were known for being the baddest dude in town. And then, you know, you have that call where they're weeping and fearful. And so for me, the ultimate thing is it's just kind of giving me this sense of I'm not a guy who gets up sunny every day and like, I'm going to drink deep from the springs of beauty in life. But I am a guy who gets up and go, oh, all right, well, another day here, not going to take it for granted. And so I think it definitely informed my own sense of mortality. But you're right, there's also a lot of goofiness. And the other thing I love about that book, there are two things. Number one, it's written about a very specific small town in Wisconsin. So on the one hand, it was such a privilege to be able to try to take a snapshot in time of that northern Wisconsin culture and try to convey that. On the flip side, one of my other greatest joys is I've toured that book from New York to L.A. and from Duluth to Jackson, Mississippi. And I remember being in Jackson, Mississippi and just having people with accents completely different than mine coming up and going, oh, your town is just like our town. And so, yeah, it just kind of was this little launching pad where I learned to write about our very specific culture and tropes and our goofiness, and yet try to do it in such a way that it resonates outside the state lines.
Right.
And then it just led to a whole bunch of other unexpected stuff. I mean, whether it's being a freelance writer or whether it's performing, I would say 90% of what I'm doing tracks back to Population 45, although I was writing for 9 years before that book came out, too. Mm. I mean, it's that classic. Mm. I'd self-published some books, and I'd done a ton of magazine writing. Did whatever it took, man. I wrote used car commercials. I wrote frozen pizza commercials. I'm a pure artist, man. Don't ever forget it.
We're speaking with Michael Perry, and Michael Perry is coming to the stage of the Racine Theater Guild this Saturday evening, the 1st of February. Michael Perry has written extensively all over the place and has all kinds of different books to his credit, including the aforementioned Population 485, Truck, A Love Story, and many, many others. And the most recent Michael Perry book that I'm holding in my hands, Peaceful Persistence, is actually a collection of essays that originally appeared in print as the Rough Neck Grace columns in the Wisconsin State Journal. Michael Perry, when I think about somebody like you who is living, on the one hand, a relatively ordinary life, I mean, a life very different from mine and from, you know, a lot of other people, but you do not live as a writer 24/7. I mean, you are also, I mean, living in rural Wisconsin and feeding the chickens and fixing the mower and whatever. I mean, life is full of all of this, and as you go about your life and your work, you are seeing things and seeing people and inspired to write about them. When I think about that, I sometimes think about the parent at their kid's concert who's staring at the concert the whole time through the screen of their cell phone recording it. And I think a lot of us are coming to realize that we end up not really hearing that concert or experiencing things because we're too busy recording them. and not really seeing them exactly for what they are. And sometimes I would think that it would be possible for that to be a potential pitfall for somebody like you, and yet it clearly isn't. I mean, you really are really seeing what's going on around you, and it isn't through some sort of careful writer's screen or writer's lens, or it doesn't come off that way. But I wonder if you ever think about that, about the way you see the world and how different that is because you are writing about the way you see the world, and everything you experience in your life is potential fodder for the next column or the next chapter of the next book.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think the fundamental things both interfere with my writing and keep me grounded in my writing. You know, I think when we started this phone call before we hit record, I told you I just took the ashes out of the wood stove and got the fire started. I have a sick child at home from school today, so I've been caring for her. And so those are things, you know, I would have preferred to have just gone to my fancy writing room somewhere overlooking some fancy view and just had someone bring me my fresh ground coffee and light the incense so that I could then go on and create timeless beauty. That's not really how it happens. And so a lot of it is just going about life. And then I always feel like and I think a lot of folks relate to this. I'm one of those folks, I get along with folks fine, but I'm pretty much a loner, and I also never quite fit the I'm not a square peg in a round hole, but I definitely have to round off some of the corners in order to fit in there. And I always feel a little awkward and out of place and uncomfortable. And where I feel most comfortable is just kind of hanging back and watching, and then taking what I've seen and heard back into I do have a little room above our garage that does look out over the back 40. It ain't bad. But if you're up there meditating, great thoughts of purity, you can be interrupted when someone opens the garage door right underneath your feet. But but anyways, I like to take those things back and then reflect on them. And the thing I never forget is that that's a privilege, man. I came from blue collar, you know, and I milk cows and I did all that stuff. And even now, even though I love what I do, I'm self-employed. We've been a little self-employed family here for several decades now. And so I still have to hustle. You know, when I come to Racine, one of my daughters is going to be running the merch table, and we'll be rolling in a 2002 Toyota van that we tore the seats out of to fit all the book boxes and T-shirt boxes in. And we'll unload that stuff and we'll stack it up. And then I'll go out and I'll have a blast doing the show. And I hope the audience will too. But then we'll load it all up, we'll haul it on back home, and we'll do the next thing. And so that, I think that helps me stay a little bit in touch. I don't have the luxury of just floating above it all. I mean, I this is probably more than you want to know, but the other thing I had to do this morning was try to figure out what the heck is wrong with our septic tank. So it's that kind of blend, and I think ultimately I do occasionally, because, you know, my books have done well enough that I do occasionally get sent out to nice literary festivals or go through what I call the cool kids circle. And I just pass through, and I love it. I'm grateful. I love meeting people who understand literature to a depth that I can't even comprehend, and I love to talk shop. But at the end of the day, I have witnessed over time how that isolation, that artistic isolation, can also really just kind of send you off the rails. And so sometimes it's the very things that I get grumpy about, that rankle me, that are dutiful, that actually allow me in the end to, I think, still communicate with folks from a ground level. Hmm. I don't know.
Love that.
That's just me kind of rambling, but that's how I go about things. But and then just that background of mine, so growing up with farmers and loggers and truckers and you know, and they're no better than anybody else. There's this whole thing now where you got to, you know, you're on one side or the other, whatever. And my life started out very blue collar, very rural, very in the dirt. And I carry that with me with love and pride. But on the other hand, I've also, my life has been changed and beautified and expanded by people in big cities and bizarre artists and real characters and people who are those very pure artists who don't, you know, they only focus on their art. And so I just feel really lucky to be able to just slop around in bad Crocs out here and yet also love some modern dance and to have benefited from the beauty that art can bring even to a knucklehead like me. And So I hope I try to convey that, you know, I try to write beautifully and thoughtfully and reflectively, but then also there's that whole roughneck humor thing that I just grew up with. When you grew up rural and we were poor, now I want to be clear, I never went to bed hungry and I never went to bed doubting that I was loved. So I had the two greatest privileges in the world. But we were literally below the poverty line, and a big old family, and things were rough around there. I knew guys missing fingers and eyes and things like that. And so one of the ways you deal with that life is you just find humor in just about everything. And so I think I was fortunate to have that artistic insight, a lot of it which was cultivated just by reading books voraciously when I was a kid. But on the other hand, being able to do, and I'll probably do this story in Racine, I have a whole story about a guy getting kicked by a dead cow. And I just love the juxtaposition of those things. And, you know, and the dead cow story comes right from my roots. It's from my blue-collar farm and knucklehead neighbors. And so I'm, as you can tell, I've made a living by rambling and going off on tangents, which I'm doing right now. But somewhere in the blend of all that is what it is that I do. And it hasn't made me rich and famous, but it has also allowed my family to make a nice little living. And I think I'll try to wrap it up, this particular riff, with this. What I'm getting at is, you talked about everything being mediated through screens. One of the things where I've been lucky, I can't sell out the Fiserv Forum or anything like that, but I can come to a theater in Racine, and we'll have a few hundred people in there, and it is an absolute, it's intimate, it's funny, it's goofy, it's heartfelt, but above all, it's a group of people just sharing a moment in time and laughing together. And I'll tell you what I can feel. I can just feel the hunger that people have for that. And even me, who I've written all about how I'm a loner and I prefer to be alone, and it is my favorite state, but I come out of those shows just feeling great hope for humanity and great gratitude that we were allowed those couple of hours in that little dark room together. Just sharing a live, real human experience.
Right. You kind of touch on that in the preface to this recent book, Peaceful Persistence, in which you talk about meeting some folks after what I think you tell us is the last live show you were able to do before COVID-19 shut everything down. And and as you're kind of talking about encountering these particular ladies from a book club who each brought you a tin of canned ham, and it was obviously in relation to something you'd written or said or something, and you know, you really had no idea of the specifics of all of that, but it just kind of, it helped you celebrate the whole matter of connection. And then you finished the preface by saying this: even as I edited this collection, written over the course of two very recent years and concluding just about the time the book club presented me with that collection of tinned meat, I was on a journey of rediscovery. When you've written as much as I have for as long as I have, it is not uncommon to read your own work and hear the voice of a stranger. But as I reread these pieces, I wasn't seeing them with my eyes or hearing them with my inner ear. I was imagining you reading them, just as I imagined you while I was writing them. And I was struck as ever by the honor and trust and closeness in this, that we are connecting even if we never meet, that we have shared time and sentiment across separation and space. It is the marvel of writing and reading. I never tire of it, and I never take it for granted.
Man, I don't know who wrote that, but I couldn't say it better.
That is one great writer.
Yeah. It's the privilege part. I had another book come out since Peaceful Resistance, a little novella called 40 Acres Deep, and the Midwestern Book Club is doing it for their next episode. I've had people just this week, people will drop on Facebook or something and say, I read the book and I liked it. And the only answer I can come up with beyond thank you is I just say, thank you for giving it your time. And I think that's what I marvel at when I sit and type this stuff. If someone reads it, they're giving me their time. And man, we've all only got so much time. And so, yeah, that gratitude comes from a very real place. Plus, again, I was just that kid on a rural farm in Wisconsin who loved to read books and never dreamed that someone might read one of mine. So, right. Yeah, it's nice.
as I was reading Peaceful Persistence last night, I was struck time and time again, maybe more so than in any of the previous books I've read of yours. I mean, all wonderfully written, but somehow as I'm reading Peaceful Persistence, I was struck again and again by the elegance of your writing. And I don't know that elegance is necessarily the first word that pops to mind when people think about Michael Perry or who Michael Perry is or your persona. I mean, as this guy from rural Wisconsin, and yet the way you turn a phrase is absolutely beautiful. And also the way you turn a phrase is also, maybe not the way you would maybe write something that you would want to maybe powerfully connect with the neighbor farmer right down the road. I mean, do you feel like you're writing for your own tribe? I mean, the people that you live with and work with? Where does this beautiful elegance of style come from?
First of all, help me remember this, because by the time I get done going off in the next tangent, I'll forget. But let me come back and say that my answer to that will be I'm writing for two audiences. But the first thing I want to say is that, yeah, if you meet me or if you hear me talk, one of my favorite compliments ever, secondhand, those are always the best, not when, someone says what they overheard. So this was back when Population 45 hadn't been out for too long, and it was getting some attention. And I have this wonderful old neighbor lady. She's no longer with us, but she, my mom raised me. But if we needed to be dropped somewhere or if something came up, we were dropped off at this neighbor lady's house. And she was just your classic tough farm wife. And so she has known me literally since I was in diapers. And this book is getting a lot of attention. And someone ran into her somewhere and found out that she knew who I was and was from where I was from. And she just, and this woman said, "Oh, Michael Perry, he writes, he's so beautifully and eloquently and the word choice and the pictures he paints." And this woman who knew me from day one just said, "Yeah, well, that ain't the way he talks." And so that then leads me to say, she couldn't have made me happier, right? That's just perfect. But then that does lead me to say that I've been criticized over the years, including in the dang New York Times, that I'm trying to have it both ways. In a nutshell, the New York Times critic said, "Oh, he wants us to think he's just a regular guy, but then he'll use, a big word, and then he's trying to prove that he's a writer." And of course, I was just like, "Dude, you didn't insult me; you just insulted all my neighbors." So, secondly, I'm aware that sometimes I overdo it. There's no question. There's times when I'll be writing for a page and a half, and then I'll think to myself, "Well, you could just say it's a shovel, right?" And so I definitely go off the rails occasionally. But the bottom line is, for a long time, I can't say I worried about it, but I tussled with it. Like, well, am I, when I start dropping my gerunds and talking about me and the chief, we was down to the cafe and we was talking about your rifles. I got a 30-06, and he's got a 243 there. And but that's how I grew up. And if my kids, when I'm on the phone, they'll chuckle and they say, "Were you just talking to your brother?" Because they can tell that I switched to that vernacular because that's how I grew up and I'm dead comfortable there. But I also believe that. So on the one hand, that's totally genuine. When I write those little riffs or when I talk that way or when I tell stories, when I tell a dead cow story, it doesn't sound like you're in some literary salon, believe me, because you'll get an insight on what it's like to sit around my brother's shop, and hear stories. But on the flip side, where I always was self-conscious was I'd get criticized for using a big word, or someone would say, "Oh, I had to look that word up in the dictionary." And my response was always like, "Well, where do you think I found it?" That's where you find words. But the ultimate thing that I came up with that I think it was to help me sort this out. I don't know if it'll help anyone out. But I said, yes, I can overdo it sometimes either way. But all in all, what I'm really trying to do is say, there's been plenty of dumbing things down, and I'm guilty of it myself. I wrote in, I think in Population, I said, I was raised so that I tend to just scoff at anything more complex than a bag of feed. Well, on the one hand, there's some lovely humility to that, and self-deprecation. But on the other hand, it can also become an excuse to never better yourself or try to learn anything new, and to just throw up barriers to anything fresh. And so, as much as I want to be true to my roots, I also want to say, hey, this other really, you know, this modern dancer, check this out. This was amazing. So I wind up going back and forth. And what I ultimately said, when it comes to the big words and the fancy words, I just said, you know, why should we let the fancy people hog all the fancy words? But they're available to me too, even though I don't necessarily know what a split infinitive is. And maybe, you know, when I'm talking to my brothers, I say these and those and them, because that's how, yeah, I tell you what, that's how I was raised there. And we was down to the, you know, the mail caller come early and he backed over the cat. What are you going to do, you know? But then you can turn right around and you can write about the glorious beauty of brassy skies and a sunset and cumulus clouds and how it reminds you of Maxfield Parrish, and you try to write like Dylan Thomas wrote. You know, I think you can live in both worlds.
Absolutely. And I want to ask you about that in a moment. I want to read the opening of Quotidian Asparagus. I once wrote of a most unassuming quotidian hour, and a reader logged in to say I kind of overdid it with quotidian. And while at first I bristled, I have an ego and have also long maintained we should not let all the fancy people hog all the fancy words, upon a reread, I reckoned she was right on. If that prose wasn't purple, it was certainly trending magenta. You hose a rose with enough perfume, you kill it. And I think that you're touching on something really important there.
Yeah, a guy doesn't always get it right, you know, and... that's funny, the ego part. So, you know, I'm very much into self-deprecation and humility, and am on a daily basis given reason to be humble. But I do have an ego, or you wouldn't, you know, put this stuff to paper. And you've reminded me once I did one column one time, and I ended it very intentionally with a very run-on comma splice sentence, because I was recreating the feel of going down the road and motion and gathering momentum and stuff, and I happen to think it worked. But some woman, some critic, anonymously registered their displeasure with my writing and said that, you know, if you were a real writer, you wouldn't have to write a long run-on sentence like that. And I never responded. I just let it go. But I made sure that the next column I wrote open with a run-on comma splice sentence that was even longer than the one that ended the previous one. So for the record, I can be petty.
Michael Perry is human. That's this. You heard it here first.
Oh, is he ever.
So let me give you an example of something in peaceful persistence that I think is a wonderful example of your beautiful turn of phrase, and this has nothing to do with even utilizing, you know, a long fancy word you might have to look up in the dictionary, but just the way words are shaped in so often in just breathtakingly beautiful fashion. So in a chapter called Goodbye Goldie, it begins this way. In a brief ceremony held under cold rain, the loyal hen Goldie, recently removed from the chest freezer where she lay wrapped in a feed bag since her death in winter, was this day buried, per my daughter's request, beneath a flowering plum tree overlooking the valley. I had quite forgotten about Goldie until my wife announced that the recent delivery of a batch of venison sausage and wieners, handcrafted by my longtime friend, neighbor, and former firefighting partner Bob, the one-eyed beagle, had taken up all available freezer space, necessitating that Goldie be removed from where she was tucked between the pork chops and frozen green beans and placed on the garage floor beside the recycling. Please see to it before the mice or she thaws, said my wife, and fair concerns these. What really leapt out at me were those last four words. So please see to it before the mice or she thaws, said my wife, and fair concern these. I love those words, but there's also a little bit of an element of where did that come from? Although it says it just perfectly. But I think that's maybe an example of that living in two worlds thing that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think it and by the way, I'm just riffing here, but I think it's also a form of translation, right? So the finding the dead chicken in your freezer with feathers on and everything, there's a whole class of people, and I've met them because A, I grew up with them, and B, they come to my readings, and I've literally had people tell their stories about the pet or the chicken or the animal that they froze over the winter so they could bury it in the spring. So on the one hand, you have this very non-artistic, very, I don't know even how to describe it in the moment, but it's pretty dang fundamental and close to the ground, and there's a certain sort of person that would be willing to freeze their dead animal in the freezer with the rest of their food. But then if you take that story, but then you end it with it, what is, here's a word for you, isn't it an, I don't know how to pronounce it, opportune, isn't there, I know how to spell it, but you have this little dollop of creme fraiche, yes, right at the end, and you just go, here's a way for both parties to enjoy the humor, right? So on the one hand, you got the folks who just love the story of the chicken, and then you've got the folks who the story of the chicken is funnier because you get really formal at the end, as if ceremonial. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's kind of, you know, I mean, and again, I've had my books taught in MFA courses and stuff, and I've seen the syllabi, and I'll see things like they'll say, well, notice how Mr. Perry employs parallel structure. And I just go, well, now I got to look up parallel structure.
And yet,
and so I equate it to, you know, I know tons of musicians, and there are musicians who can read a chart and play it flawlessly first pass through, and then there's musicians I know who have made their living as musicians for years and can't read music, and I definitely play by ear. Now, that. I chuckle at that, and I enjoy it. I mean, you know, I just made the joke about not knowing what parallel structure is or what a split infinitive is or past pluperfect and things like that. I have no idea what that stuff means. But I don't also want that to be mistaken for some sort of false pride, because a lot of my mentors, and I'm thinking even in particular of a friend that I do some co-writing with, they have studied these things, and they have an absolute in-depth understanding of them. And I turn to them all the time. You know, there's this whole anti-intellectual thing happening, and I don't want to be guilty of that. I'm just saying I just happen to be a guy who, because of my path, which was not through English or MFA, I'm doing all this by ear, and I'm hoping that most of the time I get it right, and I don't always. But
I think, for the most part, you absolutely get it right, and I know your many fans feel that way as well. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking to best-selling author Michael Perry, Wisconsin's own, and he is coming to the stage of the Racine Theater Guild this Saturday evening, February 1st. If I can just tilt things a little bit serious for a moment, I mean, maybe more serious than what we were just talking about, this matter of, in a sense, living in two worlds brings to mind the fact that right now we are living at a moment in time when our country just seems to be fractured, where there is a really bitter divide politically, socially, and in a lot of different ways. And we also hear so much about the split between urban and rural and so on and so forth. I'm just wondering how aware you are as you live your life and as you write and so on. I mean, you will make sometimes kind of glancing reference to, the kind of volatile, critical voices that sort of pour out invective online, particularly, and so on. So clearly, you are not isolated from any of that. But I wonder if you could just say a word about navigating, in a sense, two worlds, and navigating what I'm sure, at least at times, is maybe kind of an uneasy divide.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm not sure I always get it right at all. But I will say, and it is very tricky to say the least, but I will say that the way that I've tried to frame it, and believe me, I've had people take me to task from both, I hate even saying sides, but both sides. You know, you're not saying enough about this, you're not saying enough about that. And the point that I make with him is that I know all the tropes, and I myself, you know, if you can't read between the lines and figure out where I'm at, you know, then maybe maybe I'm not doing my job. I don't know. But what I do know is this business of the binary take that you're either good or you're evil. It applies probably to a few people on the fringes, but the fact is there's just a whole bunch of us here just trying to get about our lives and trying to communicate with each other. And it just so happens that, yes, a good portion of my audience feels strongly one way, and then a smaller but significant portion of my audience feels the other way. And so I'll have people say, well, you don't want to say anything because you're worried about not selling books. I'm like, dude, if you saw my royalty checks, you would know that this is not predicated on me trying to protect my book sales. as a matter of fact, if I wanted to sell more, I would come down very clearly and I would just recite all the tropes that you can hear all day long and find all day long on social media. And then the minute I do that, then I don't really have anything fresh to say. But if I can cast positive doubt in some ways, for instance, I know for a fact, and I allude to this pretty regularly, I was just at the fire meeting the other night, I know for a fact that I'm not voting with some of those folks, probably the majority, but they will have my back and I will have theirs, and they will drop what they're doing if my kid gets hurt or if our house starts on fire, and that's just a fact. And so I am trying as best I can to navigate that. Not by saying, here's what you should think, but here's what I see. Here's what I've heard. Here's what I've witnessed. And I'm also have gone to great lengths in my writing to say that I'm aware that that ain't enough. And we need people who work the bleeding edge. We need people who make the strong statements. We need people who lead. I've never been cut out for that. Even, you know, I've written about being a firefighter. The last thing I wanted to be was an officer. I just hand me the hose. I will go in the burning barn. And so I don't, it's something I struggle with all the time. And I even hate to use the word struggle because I have a good life and I don't want to overdo the drama there. But it's kind of like I was talking about using a big word. Sometimes I get it wrong. But what I do know is that if I come out, I just had someone approach me from one of the political parties here recently, and they want me to come out and endorse this person and do this thing. But I know that the minute I do that, then that the discussion is over for me. And what I also have a hard time conveying to them is you're going to get a whole lot less help from me than you think. But if I'm out, if I can cast gentle doubt just by the way that I write things, that's probably the best I'm equipped to do. And I'm fully prepared to have people tell me, no, you're cowardly, you're weak, and you're wrong. But I am not living in one world. And I also think I've had some experience recently working with Hollywood on some script things, and I had a development deal. And I love saying that I had a development deal because it sounds really fancy to work. Really, it just means you got a little bit of money for something you wrote, and then everybody just fights with each other, and it turns into lawyers and agents, and then you never talk to anyone again. But just, you know, they're just all of a sudden amazed. They're like, when I explain about being a volunteer firefighter or EMT, they just have no sense of this world. And trying to convey that to them, and all of a sudden, about 2 months ago, I'm getting all these emails going, oh, we didn't know about this, and we didn't know about that. And I'm saying, no, some of us have been writing about this for 20 years. You just chose to do something different. So I'm kind of muddling along in my own confusion here at this point. Mm-hmm. But that's my best answer, is that I don't have a good answer. Mm-hmm. And other than to try and find the humanity in people, and yeah. And listen, I mean, if you read Montaigne and Barn Boots, it's pretty clear. You know, I have a chapter in there called Roughneck Intersectionality, and that's probably about as definitive as I've ever gotten about it. And I say the thing that breaks my heart the most is I tell a story about being in a boat with a guy in rural Canada and what his concerns were. And I could tell that his concerns had nothing to do with his reality. They had to do with what he was listening to all day.
Right.
And I said, that's what breaks my heart, is that we're all getting mad at each other, not because of what we did to each other, but because of what someone in the distance yelling told us we did to each other. And I just know it's harder to fight nonstop with somebody if you're both at the fire meeting.
Right.
It can happen.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, I will end this by saying I'm fully prepared to hear people say that I'm not making the right call, but here we are.
Somewhere in peaceful.
I mean, my own family. You know, my own family does not see. You know, these divides that we're alluding to.
Right.
It's at my Thanksgiving, so I do have people occasionally say, "Well, those people, and how can you this or that?" I go, "Well, because you know they're my blood."
Mm. Somewhere in your book, "Peaceful Persistence" is a wonderful phrase, and I've been frantically paging as I've been listening to you and can't find it. But you say something at some point about how one of the things that you end up doing as a writer is you send words out into the world and see how they ricochet. And something about how that's kind of how we learn about the world. We learn about ourselves. We learn about how things work. We learn about what people are like, especially people who see the world differently than I do. And I think you do such a wonderful job with that. I want to highlight something that I hope you will maybe have a moment or two to allude to when you're on the stage of the Theater Guild. And that is a wonderful chapter in Peaceful Persistence called Auditions. And it opens this way. Among the ways one proves one is serious about parenting is to spend the second half of one of the better professional football playoff games of the year helping an 11-year-old fill out audition forms at the local children's theater. And it's just a great, great story. But it also touches, of course, on the matter of becoming a father relatively late in life. And of course, you write about matters of fatherhood as well as of being a husband quite extensively. And I wonder if you can just talk about how you navigate that matter of what to share and how to share about the most deeply personal corners of your personal life.
Oh, yeah. So that's... Well, first of all, when I met my wife and my elder daughter, my elder daughter was 3 when I met her and her mom. They already knew what I was doing. I mean, a 3-year-old, of course, didn't give a rip. But and part of the reason I even met my wife is because she came to a reading. She had no idea who I was. She was dragged there by friends. She had no interest. She enjoyed the, you know, I did some humor, like I'll do at Racine, but she sent me an email afterwards saying, I just saw you perform and I enjoyed it. But she said, and this was critical, she said, but I don't know if you're anything like that guy on the stage. And man, that was smart. Because
wow.
I am, you know, what you'll see in Racine, it'll be fun and humorous and heartfelt. And that's all real. It's from the heart. It's truly me. But of course, it's, you know, an edited section of the bandwidth. It's not me on any given Tuesday morning with dirty socks. So that's, you know, when I met my wife, she knew that I wrote about, you know, I wrote personal memoir. We didn't put it in those terms, but she knew that's what I did. And so she knew that I would write. And so I've changed names, but obviously in small towns and stuff, it really doesn't take that long to figure out who's who. And I did learn, my wife has a kind of a benevolent disinterest in my work, which I treasure. And, yeah, if we're in bed reading, she's usually reading Wendell Berry, not Mike Perry. But anyways, I did learn pretty early that if I'm going to write about her, I really ought to let her just have a quick scan, at least, for fact-checking, if nothing else. But when it came to the kids, what I did is I followed on the advice of a writer that I admired, and I always blank on his name, but he had 2 daughters. And he wrote for The New Yorker for years. And he just said that once they turned teen, he didn't write about them till they were out of college. Because he said no teenager deserves to have a parent telling, you know, about their troubles and travails. I told my daughters, that guy came from money. We don't come from money. So I said, I'm not going to stop writing about you. But I'm not going to embarrass you or humiliate you. And if there's serious things, you know, it's going to wait. And frankly, I'm living it right now because I have a book on hold. I was writing a book about daughters, dads and daughters. And, you know, one of my children is facing some challenges that she said I can write about, but I frankly don't think it's time. And so that book is on hold. And so, yes, I do at points, I will just say, you know, if folks can get a chuckle out of this, or if folks can take something meaningful from this, I think I can share it. But if we're really getting into some of the difficult nitty gritty, you know, the time and a place. The other thing you always want to remember is that, you know, someday they can write their own books too. So maybe do the math on that before you spill too much, right? So, yeah, it's not really even a fine line. I mean, I think you know, and if it's an entertaining little story, or you know, or if it's a heartbreaking story, and you feel others can relate to it, fine. But yeah, I don't have any. There's nothing deep and dark to hide, but there are personal battles when you're a teenager and making those transitions that I think are can wait.
Mm. Well, I think you make so many good choices each and every time you sit down to write, and you share in ways that feel so open, so real, so incredibly authentic, and it is what draws people to your books. And I hope we'll draw many people to seek out your performance coming up on Saturday evening, February 1st at the Racine Theater Guild. Actually, I shouldn't even say performance. A presentation maybe is a better word, because performance...
Performance is fine, because it really is. I just wander out with the microphone. I bring books with me, but mostly I tell stories, a lot of humor, and then I'll just pick, you know, some pieces, and I'll try to remember the audition piece. But one of the things I did when I first started writing, and you probably got to wrap this up, but when I've got my first book deal with Harper for Population 45, I knew they were going to send me on tour, and I didn't know what an author tour even was. So I would drive to Minneapolis a couple of times a month and go watch author signings at bookstores and see how they handled it. And I quickly learned that some of my favorite authors were amazing writers, were really boring speakers or awkward. And then I learned that people I'd never heard of were highly entertaining. Like, you would have just come just to hear them talk. And so what I've always tried to do is to convey content from my books, but I don't just read at people. I mean, I will tell stories off the cuff. I have some well-polished stories. I tell, you know, probably will open with a story I almost always open with, which is a story about a beer tent in a small town. It's one of my favorite stories ever. And then just kind of roll with it. And there's a certain amount of comedy to it. And then there's definitely some parts where I let the words speak for themselves too. So I always say, if you come to one of my, like the event I'm going to do it at the Theater Guild Racine there, you can show up in your Birkenstocks or your barn boots and you'll have a good time.
Of that I have no doubt. Michael Perry comes to the Racine Theater Guild this Saturday evening, February 1st. You can call the box office at 262-633-4218 to get more information. Michael Perry, it's been wonderful to reconnect with you. Thank you for all the great writing you've done over the years, and thank you for this time.
Thank you for giving me your time. Thanks for having me.
And tomorrow on the morning show, excerpts from three of my previous morning show interviews with Michael Perry. And if you would like more information about him, his life, his books, and his performance schedule, please seek out his wonderful website, sneezingcow.com. And yes, tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear excerpts from the interviews that I recorded with Michael Perry, talking about three of his previous books: Truck, A Love Story; Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting; and Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. I find it hard to believe, but the earliest of those three interviews was recorded 17 years ago. And on Thursday and Friday of this week, conversations pro and con about the proposed natural gas power plant in the town of Paris. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast version of the morning show. Look for the morning show with Greg Berg. Today is going to be mostly sunny, and high winds are expected once again today. A high temperature of 49 degrees. We could see winds up to 50 miles per hour by mid-afternoon. Clear skies overnight, still windy, an overnight low of 33. Sunny, windy, and mild tomorrow with a high of 43 degrees. Very similar conditions expected to continue on Thursday with a 40% chance of rain in Friday's forecast. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine,